Our speaker this evening is just an old broken down school teacher. That's the way he told me to introduce him. But for those who don't know him, I'd better add a thought or two. He's remarkably qualified to speak on the subject of the problem of the cognitive and theological discourse. Sterling got his PhD at the University of Southern California. Since then, he has done postgraduate work at Columbia, Princeton, Union Theological Seminary in New York. He's received 6 honorary doctorates from various universities. He was professor of philosophy at USC for 3 years back in the 40s, at the University of Utah for the last 32 years, or 34 years. Sterling has held every office but president. He's been professor, dean, dean of the graduate school, provost, academic vice president. In fact, he could have been president, I think, but he refused to run. Did not choose to run. One time he was U.S. Commissioner of Education. I have a list of 2 pages of commissions he served on and in the role of a consultant and many others. Of special interest to us at this symposium is the fact, I think, that Sterling is the author of some very excellent books on Mormonism. The Philosophical Foundations of Mormonism, The Theological Foundations of Mormonism. He just published a book entitled Religion, Reason, and Truth, Essays in the Philosophy of Religion. More important to me than all of his accomplishments and his studies in religion and philosophy is the fact that he's a very genuine human being. The brilliant mind and with intellectual and moral integrity does me a great honor to introduce this broken down old teacher who will now speak to us.
Banyan, Miss Fletcher, and friends, can I be heard back there all right? Can I be heard now? I deeply appreciate this most generous introduction by Lowell Banyan, and when he was described as the only saint among the Latter-day Saints, that's getting very, very close to the truth. I can look around, find one or two more probably. Lowell is the most humane human being and a very, very dear friend. When Peggy Fletcher asked me if I would address this audience for this occasion, I told her several times, absolutely not. But she's a very persistent character. My wife has said that the trouble with Peggy is that she doesn't know things can't be done, so she just goes ahead and does them. And what she has done with her associates in developing this theological symposium is, I think, really quite remarkable. I would venture to say that tomorrow there will be 3 or 4 times as many people participating in the symposium as there are here this evening. And I think it's a most unusual thing and a remarkable tribute to the young people who are responsible for it. She talked about the events of the weekend being very exciting. Now, I must say that my subject is a very unexciting subject. So it's perhaps a rather dull beginning for what I'm sure will be tremendously interesting weekend. On the other hand, I think it's of very basic importance for people who presume to take an interest, and a serious interest, in theological matters to face the question of the cognitive meaning of theological sentences, theological propositions. The question, of course, is simply this. It's a question as to whether, when people discuss theology, they are talking sense or simply a lot of nonsense. And I must tell you in advance that I personally think that most theology is simply a lot of nonsense. I mean that quite seriously. And the problem that anyone who has a real interest in theology should eventually face is the question of whether it is actually possible to construct genuine theological propositions which do make sense. I was asked earlier this evening, before the dinner, what is intended by the term cognitive meaning. What is intended, of course, as many of you know very well, is simply knowledge meaning. Quite possible to talk in terms of other kinds of meaning, as one, of course, you might use such an expression as emotional meaning, or conceivably even valuational meaning or something like that. But the issue that I want to present to you this evening is simply the question as to whether theology actually is the kind of thing which in principle is capable of conveying some kind of knowledge. One of my teachers, one of the really great philosophical scholars, Heinrich Gompertz, wrote back in the 20s a very famous essay entitled The Meanings of Meaning. And that was a period when the whole philosophical enterprise in academic circles, both in Europe and then a little later in this country, became heavily involved in the question of meaning. As I recall, Gompertz identified something on the order of 17 different kinds of meaning for the idea of meaning. And cognitive meaning, of course, which is what we usually employ the term meaning to designate. With only one of these. Now, ordinarily, when we talk about theological matters, we tend to raise the question of whether or not such sentences as there is a God or there is a soul, to take two examples of theological sentences which employ key theological words, God and soul. We generally, in dealing with sentences of this kind, raise the question as to whether they are true or false. The question of cognitive meaning is not the question of whether the sentences are true or false. It is the question as to whether they are the kinds of things that are either true or false. A former colleague of mine, who was a visiting professor, and his contract wasn't renewed for the next year after he made this speech, a person of very sound positivistic leanings. He went to Caltech, where he now teaches philosophy. The boys were studying science. But he to illustrate the point of the possibility of the meaninglessness of theological sentences. I said some people say there is a God, and some people say there isn't a God, and the truth lies somewhere in between. And this tends to get at the thing. Now, my wife told me when we were coming this evening, I hope you're going to put a little humor into the things that you have to say. Now, that's one half of the humor that I can put out on this subject. I might as well give you the other half now and get it over with. Because what I intend to do is simply describe for you the position of logical positivism in its more classical form, that is a form that it took especially in the late 20s, 30s, and 40s, with respect to theological sentences. The other piece of humor that I have is a statement by one of my teachers, Professor William Pepperell Montague, who in a conversation said, "This negativism called positivism." And I think that some of you might feel that he's quite right in that kind of criticism. The positivistic position, which I'm interested in describing, actually achieved a kind of maturity around 1950. The most vigorous and most competent critics of logical positivism, which is a form of logical analysis and which developed primarily among German-speaking scientists and logicians and philosophers, included in itself its own best critics. And many of the leading positivists who formed, as some of you are well aware, in the 20s, the so-called Viennese Circle at the University of Vienna, migrated to the United States during the Hitler era, one or two to Scandinavia and to England, but this country was the chief mecca for them, and found that they had a great deal in common with American pragmatism, especially of the type that was being put out in those days by John Dewey and particularly Charles Morris, who then was a professor at the University of Chicago. And the result is that this more or less German language born type of philosophy came to its maturity for the most part in English speaking countries, and particularly this country. And its critics from within the school of thought itself, over a period of time, liberalized it to a considerable degree. The most brilliant critic, in my opinion, was Carl Hempel at Princeton University. And if a person were to bring this type of philosophic thought up to date, it would be a little bit like trying to bring American pragmatism up to date. That is, the school of thought tended to, in a sense, disintegrate, but in the disintegration had a tremendous impact on the general intellectual climate of the country, particularly those who are interested professionally in philosophy and in ethics and in such things as theology. And the point of my mentioning this is that I don't intend to bring it up to date because the shock value of positivism is to be found in the earlier form. And it's the shock value that I'm interested in becoming involved with this evening. Now, the point is whether or not, as I've already indicated, sentences which employ key theological terms of the type that theologians commonly use and that religious believers commonly employ and usually believe to be true, whether they really are the kinds of things that convey knowledge, that is, are they the kinds of things that are either true or false. It's easily recognizable, for instance, that many sentences are not true or false. Sentences such as in poetry are not true or false. And the question is whether certain kinds of sentences which are employed in theology, and the same is true in the field of normative ethics, where you're dealing with what ought or ought not to be the case, or what ought or ought not to be done, it's whether in fact they are simply disguised as genuine, cognitively meaningful propositions, disguised by the syntactical arrangement of the symbols, and disguised by the kinds of symbols that are employed, because they're familiar symbols. When, as a matter of fact, these symbols may have no genuine semantic reference, and the sentence turns out not to be a genuine proposition, but what the positivists themselves call a pseudo-proposition. Now, the positivists were, for the most part, in the heyday of positivism, physicists and physical scientists of one kind and another, and logicians, as I have already mentioned. The high priest of the crowd, Rudolf Carnap, who was a professor at the University of Prague in Czechoslovakia, came to this country and was at the University of Chicago, later at the Institute at Princeton, and then at UCLA. Carl Hempel was at the University of Berlin, later at Yale, and then Princeton, whom I have already mentioned. I mention these names simply because they are, in my opinion, the major figures in this country in positivism. In England, the person who has been most in evidence is A.J. Ayer, a person whose name is familiar to many of you, and he wrote a brilliant book setting forth the positivistic principles of logical positivism. It has a marvelous chapter in it entitled Ethics and Theology, and if you're interested in pursuing this sort of thing and have not done so in the past, I strongly recommend that you get A.J. Ayer's book, Language, Truth, and Logic. It's a small book, it's inexpensive, it's paperback, and it's delightful reading. And anyone who is a theologian, or an aspiring theologian, or a perspiring theologian, should be subjected to A.J. Ayer's great little book, Language, Truth, and Logic, done at Oxford University. Now, in propositions are what conveys meaning. I'm giving you the logical analysis of the logical positivist, something that is agreed to by many who would not be regarded as positivists, and who would not think of themselves as that. It's the proposition that conveys the meaning. There's the proposition that is true or false. And the sentence, in some way or another, is the bearer of the proposition. And the facts are what makes the proposition true or false. You hear people talk about the true facts. And if those things are true facts, in order to have true facts, you'd have to also have some false facts. Obviously, there aren't any false facts, so there aren't any true facts. It's the proposition that is true or false. And if the proposition is true or false, we call the sentence true or false. But some sentences are not a kind of thing that can be true or false, and so they are not barriers of propositions. Now then, it is customary among logicians that this itself has been subjected to very thorough critical analysis, and the differentiation which I will make here, though very, very useful, is subject to some criticism in contemporary logic. But that's a long story, and I don't want to get involved in it this evening. It's very important, I think, for all of us to recognize that there are two kinds of propositions. What logicians commonly refer to as analytical propositions and synthetic propositions. These are terms that were invented in the 18th century by Immanuel Kant due to the kind of analysis that he was involved in the acceptance, which was general in his day, of the Aristotelian framework for logic, such a predicate type of logic. Today it is a little more useful to refer to the analytical propositions as formal propositions and the synthetic propositions as factual propositions. But our concern here this evening is with the question of factual propositions. But to get the feel of it, you have to recognize what is meant by an analytical or a formal proposition. A formal proposition is a proposition which, by the very nature of the case, is necessarily true or necessarily false. If it's necessarily false, it is called a contradiction. And if it is necessarily true, it is simply called a formal proposition or a true proposition. Rudolf Carnap, whom I mentioned earlier, used as examples to illustrate this. A proposition, it is raining or it is not raining. We have to accept the Aristotelian principle of excluded middle to go along with him on this, but most logicians do accept that. It is raining or it is not raining. This is a formal proposition because the truth of the proposition is established simply by examining the logical and syntactical, that is, the formal structure of the proposition, or if you prefer to call it, the sentence. In other words, if a person asks you, is this sentence true? It is raining or it is not raining. You don't have to go to the window and look out at the weather in order to answer the question. It is true by its very nature. As Carnap said, it is true in every possible case and cannot be false in any possible case. And in the case of a contradiction, where you have a sentence such as, it is raining and it is not raining here now, you of course have a proposition which is false in every possible case and cannot be true in any possible case. Now the point is, and the reason I mention that, is that propositions of this kind are generally regarded as being meaningful, as in a sense being true or false, but they have what can be called formal truths or formal falsities, or what logicians more commonly refer to as analyticity. They are analytically true or analytically false. you arrive at their truth or falsity simply by examining the logic of the proposition and the syntax of the proposition, which really amounts to the same thing. Now then, large numbers of formal propositions are employed in theology because definitions of the type that we usually employ when we construct a verbal definition, where we say such and such a word means a certain thing. The definitions are formal propositions. They're neither true nor false. They can be good definitions or bad definitions, depending upon whether they are useful or not useful, whether they're confusing or clarify the discourse. But they're not true or false. As Carnap says, in definitions, there are no morals. You can define a word any way you want to. If you want to confuse everybody, define it in such a way that they won't know what you mean. But it isn't a case of your definition being false. If the question is of it being simply a poor definition. Some of you may recall some years ago the work in the philosophy of religion and theology of Henry Nelson Wyman, who was professor of philosophy in the Divinity School at the University of Chicago. Wyman could write hundreds and hundreds of pages and make you think that he was talking about God, when as a matter of fact, just talking about the word God. You couldn't possibly be wrong in much that he had to say, because he was involved in the construction of definitions and was talking about words. And here you are not involved, directly in what we would ordinarily think of as theology. But in theology, as in any kind of intellectual endeavor, it's necessary, obviously, to employ definitions. The usual view of the nature of mathematics, which follows the principle of logistics that is developed by Bertrand Russell and Alfred North Whitehead, is that mathematics is essentially, in the last analysis, a definitional in character. That's not the language that they use. Here's the thesis of logistics. When you say 2 plus 2 equals 4, this is true not because, as a matter of fact, 2 plus 2 equals 4, but because 2 plus and 2 are defined as meaning 4. So that you can substitute the symbol 4 for the symbols 2 plus and 2 when they're set forth in that order. The point is that in matters of formal sentences or formal propositions, where the truth or falsity does not depend upon any matter of fact, but depends upon the logical, or that is, the formal structure and the syntactical arrangement of the symbols in the sentence, and depends upon the logic of the language, the formal definition, the formal propositions are true, or if they're contradictions, which some are, they are false. But now, no theologian, I want to stick with theologians, but they're only a small part of the story. No theologian is willing to admit that his great theological enterprise is simply made up of definitions. I once said to Henry Nelson Wyman when I was young and foolish, and said it in front of a public audience, when you die, it should be placed upon your tombstone, "Here lies Henry Nelson Wyman, the great definer of the word God." He didn't like it one bit, I can tell you that. It was a rather rash thing for me to say. But nevertheless, it's important to recognize that in the case of propositions of that kind, you have what can be called formal truth or formal falsity. It's generally agreed that in instances of this kind, as in logic and mathematics, you're able to have certainty. That is, it's absolutely certain if you accept certain fundamental logical principles of the kind that most logicians do. It's absolutely certain that the proposition is raining or it is not raining here now is a true proposition. But if you have the proposition, it is raining here now, you have something quite different on your hands. You no longer have a proposition, the truth value of which can be determined by an analysis of the proposition itself. This brings you into contact with the weather. Up until then, you've simply been dealing with logic and language, the symbols, syntax. But now if you say it is raining here now, you're dealing with the weather. And the only way you can determine whether that is true or false is to check up on the facts. The facts make it true or false. And it's for this reason that this is called a factual proposition. Or technically, to use the Kantian language, sometimes called a synthetic proposition. But that's due to the old-fashioned logic which was employed in Kant's day. Now then, the question that we face when we ask whether or not theology has cognitive meaning has to do with factual propositions. Are factual propositions genuinely possible in theological discourse? Now, obviously, if you write an essay in theology, you do employ many sentences which are not theological in character. But those aren't the sentences that are at issue. The sentences that are at issue are the ones which make theological assertions and can easily be identified for purposes of example by the employment of such symbols as I already mentioned at the outset, God and the soul, typical theological symbols that figure prominently in theological discourse. And so the problem is, can you construct a genuinely, cognitively meaningful sentence such as, there is a God? Well, now, as you well know, there is a God is a sentence regarded by some people whom we would call atheists as false. We try to be polite in our society and not call perfectly good, honest, honorable atheists atheists. So we coin some other term because the word atheism has in our society generally taken on the connotation of being a bad person as well as a person who holds that the sentence there is a God is false. It is unfortunate because there isn't a very good term to substitute for the term atheist. But a person who holds that the proposition is false is an atheist. A person who holds that it is true is, of course, a theist, or, to use the term in a kind of non-technical way. And a person who holds that he doesn't know whether the proposition is true or false, of course, we refer to as an agnostic. A good thoroughgoing agnostic is not one who doesn't know, it's one who holds that not only he doesn't know, but neither does anyone else, and it's the kind of thing that nobody is going to know whether the proposition is true or false. Now, the important thing is to recognize that as far as a really good, honorable positivist is concerned, logical positivist, You have to keep in mind that logical positivism, though it has very early antecedents in the logic, for instance, of Leibniz and in the empirical philosophy of David Hume, the 17th, then the 18th century, and in the agnosticism of Immanuel Kant, late in the 18th century. Though it has these early antecedents, logical positivism is essentially a 19th century philosophical development. That's the 19th century's great gift to theology, is to hold that theology is meaningless. It's the most important thing in theology that has happened, I think, in this century. I say that quite seriously. Now then, the logical positivist, you understand, holds that the theist is wrong and that the atheist is just as wrong as the theist, and the agnostic is just as wrong as both of the others. They're all three in error, because in order for a proposition to be false, the atheistic position, it has to be just as meaningful as it must be for it to be true. And for a person to take seriously an agnostic position, that you cannot know whether the proposition is true or false, you have presumably the assumption that it is true or false, though you don't know which one. The positivist position is they are all wrong because they all think that either the proposition is true or it's false, or it is true or false, but we don't know which. When, as a matter of fact, it isn't any of these. It isn't true because it's meaningless. It isn't false because it's meaningless. And it isn't true or false, of course, because it's meaningless. It can't be false if you're a proposition. If you're a proposition, you can't be false unless you are meaningful. Now, if you're a proposition, it really would be better to be false than to be meaningless. I think that's perfectly obvious. Probably the best condition would be to be true. But if you're a false proposition, you're at least a genuine proposition. But if you are neither true nor false, you are what is ordinarily in logic referred to as a pseudo-proposition. That's a bad condition to be in. Now then, the point of the foregoing positivists is that these theological sentences are not propositions at all. They are pseudo-propositions. They are neither true nor false. They appear to be true or false simply because of their employment of the various kinds of symbols, and they are disguised by the syntax because to say God exists has essentially the same kind of syntax as to say this rostrum exists. And so it looks like it is a statement of fact. Or to say that there is an immortal soul appears to be a statement of fact, just as much as if you were to say the rain is falling outside. But the positivistic position is these are not statements of fact. They're pseudo-propositions. They're good sentences, you understand. But there are plenty of sentences that aren't true or false, as I've already pointed out. They are sentences which convey pseudo-propositions. The early positivists in the 20s and very early 30s said we can sign sentences like this, like these, to the poets, because they're nonsense. Now, they meant nonsense in a very technical way. That is, there is no sensory data which in principle can be brought to bear on the truth or falsity of the proposition to determine their truth value or their probability value. This used to make the poets mad, and so the positivists began to say these propositions do not have cognitive meaning. That's where the title of my statement came from tonight. A few years ago, 30 years ago, would have just said theology is meaningless and is a kind of poetry. The poets don't like that. And so we say that I'm identifying myself with. As a matter of fact, I wrote on positivism at one time to show how false it was, and was converted to it. And I warn you that if you're easily converted to things, don't start reading any of this positivist literature if you want to continue on with your career as theologian, because it can easily corrupt. Now then, the problem is to have some kind of criteria, of course, of cognitive meaning. The earliest positivist, Lowell has to go. He's got an appointment. I told him if he would introduce me and just walk out, as he walked out, I would say to you, now how about that? The earliest positivist in Vienna, of which Moritz Schlick, physicist, was the leader, the leader of the Viennese circle, were quite extreme. And there was a gradual liberalizing of the positivistic position. I just want to call your attention to the nature of that liberalization. And the need for it, it should be perfectly obvious. Moritz Schlick invented the famous proposition, there are mountains on the other side of the moon. This is back in the early 20s, and he didn't realize that somebody could go around the other side of the moon and take a look. And they adopted the principle of verification theory of meaning, or verification concept of meaning. You can't verify proposition is true or false, then it is meaningless. Now, they didn't intend to take that very seriously. That was just a starting point. And jump from that to the criterion, which is tremendously important, and that is verifiability in principle. That even though you may not be able to verify or disconfirm the proposition, that is to establish that it is true or false, it has to be capable in principle of being done. That is, in order for you to justify the employment of your sentence as conveying a genuine proposition, you have to tell what kinds of experiences would have to be had to establish it as being true or false. Not that you have to have the experiences, but that you'd have to tell what kinds of experiences. It was the case of the mountains on the other side of the moon. That's the only thing I know. You'd have to tell what kinds of experiences. It was the case of the mountains on the other side of the moon. As the only thing I know about astronomy is the moon keeps the same face toward the Earth, and that kind of complicates it, but it makes a marvelous example that Schlick invented. But you can verify this, you see, by holding up a long stick with a mirror on the other side or something like that and taking a look at the other side. Though it can't be done, you can designate what would have to be done. Or go around the other side and take a look, which he certainly thought no one would ever do. Or get some kind of an X-ray camera and take a picture through the moon and see the mountains on the other side. This is a tremendously important step in a logical analysis. And that is that you have to be able to verify in principle
not in fact. That is, you have to be able to designate the kinds of experiences that are relevant to the determination of the truth or falsity of the proposition. Then another liberalization was to shift from establishing truth or falsity to establishing a probability value of the proposition. It has a high probability or a low probability, because as you know, positivism is an empirical type of methodology, and empiricism generally avoids the notion these days, avoids the notion that you can establish factual propositions as being true or false. You can establish formal propositions as being true or false, but not factual propositions, because every factual proposition depends for its truth or falsity upon the truth or falsity of some other factual proposition. You have a hard problem on your hands. I didn't intend to refer to Carnap all the time, but Carnap's example to illustrate that tremendously important point was the proposition, "This key is made of iron." And the most thoroughgoing empiricists today regard factual propositions as simply being hypothetical propositions. "As this key is made of iron, if this key is made of iron," is a sentence which is true if some other sentence is true. A sentence having to do, for instance, with tests of iron, oxidization, chemical composition, and so on. And since they are factual sentences, they are always true if some other sentences are true. The result being that you can never establish the absolute truth or the absolute falsity of an empirically grounded factual proposition, because you can't get away from that regress. So now the positivistic position became that a proposition is meaningful if you can designate some experience that would have relevance to the determination of its probability value, that is, its probability or improbability. Now that is what is generally called the verifiability a principle of meaning, but it should be called a verifiability theory of meaning, should be called a verifiability in principle conception of meaning. Then, of course, there are the propositions that are established by logical inference, such as for instance, propositions in subatomic physics, where you simply cannot... You cannot observe an electron, because to observe it, you'd have to throw light on it, and it moves away with the speed of light. But you infer the existence of the electron from other propositions, and so on, which ultimately are observable and are presumably, therefore, testable. Now, it is this kind of line of reasoning that became the great criticism of theological discourse over the last half century. It's one that simply cannot be ignored by anyone who is interested seriously in theology. Now, you can be interested in theology without being seriously interested in it. If you're not seriously interested in it, ignore all of this kind of stuff, because it takes a little time and it can wear you out. But if you are seriously interested in theology, you ought to require of yourself that you get into the literature of the positivistic and other linguistic analytical critiques of theology, which developed especially among the British in this century, the logical developing especially among the Germans and then in this country. If you're seriously interested in theology, you need to face this question. And the question, you see, is whether you can really establish a semantic reference to a word like God or a word like the soul. Or are you just using words, talking through our heads? Now, if you cannot, some way or another, come to grips with the criteria of meaningfulness in such a way that you can at least handle this neo-positivistic criticism, then you're not in very good shape as a theologian, it seems to me. I'm going to shift for a moment, and I won't have much more to say because I know that you're probably getting tired. I'm going to shift for a moment to Mormonism because I know that many of you are interested in Mormon theology. You see, the positivistic critique is primarily a criticism of what I would simply call sophisticated, cultivated theology. Now, I don't regard Mormon theology as either sophisticated or well-cultivated. And as a matter of fact, if you were to face a positivist in Mormon terms, he would probably think that he had finally found a theologian who made some sense. Made some sense because the Mormons tend to convert theology, which in its more cultivated form is a department of metaphysics. The Mormons have a tendency to convert it into physics. Physics, for a positivist, makes perfectly good sense. It's metaphysics that doesn't make any sense for the positivist. As a matter of fact, that's one of the best definitions of positivism, is to say that positivism is a philosophical... I'm referring not to the old-style sociologically-oriented positivism of the 19th century, you understand that. Just referring to this logically oriented positivism that is called logical empiricism, sometimes scientific empiricism, and more frequently logical positivism of this century. The positivistic position has developed, you see, around the traditional conception of God and the soul, which are shot through roughly with what you might refer to as supernaturalism, and Mormonism is shot through with a kind of naturalistic position. And the Mormon theology is highly materialistic, whereas all of you well know traditional Christian and Jewish and even Islamic theology is immaterialistic. That's kind of an awkward term to use, but useful. A positivist, you see, would say, how can you make sense of the word God? Because when you say God exists, what kind of experiences can you describe that if they were had, not that you have to have them, that if they were had, would throw some kind of evidence on the truth or falsity of the proposition? Now, I'm not saying that that can't be done. What I am saying is that I don't think that it has been done very well. But now if a person from some primitive culture comes along and says, well, now look, what I mean by God is that volcano. His theology obviously makes perfectly good sense to the most thoroughgoing of the positivists. If he wants to call the volcano God and the volcano's eruption a coming forth of the Word of God or something of that kind makes the best of sense for a positivist, but that's not the way cultivated theologians usually behave. They do not usually identify God with something in the natural universe that belongs within the framework of physical reality. But now then, along comes a Mormon who believes that God has a material body, and he believes that the soul is material, and the positivist is going to pick up his ears and decide he's finally found a theologian living in a cultivated society who makes sense. Now, mind you, he would say it makes sense, but it's not true. But at least it has that value of making a certain amount of sense. But there's no point in celebrating this very long, because the positivist would say, for instance, you mean to tell me that Joseph Smith saw God? Yes, I mean to tell you that. Well, did he see God like you and I can see that telephone pole? That's not a telephone pole, but that pillar. Now, you know, some Mormons would say yes, but some of them are a bit more thoughtful and wouldn't be quite as ready to say yes. He saw God like he saw that telephone pole. You can see a telephone pole. And do you mean to tell me that if there was an animal there, a horse, that he would have seen God? Well, no. Now, about this soul business, you say the soul is material. Yes, but it's very refined. It's a very, very refined matter. No Mormon theologian has ever explained to us what that refined matter is, but this much we know for sure, that it's matter. I think we owe this probably more to Orson Pratt than anybody else. Orson Pratt held that for anything to be real, it has to occupy space. And to occupy space, it has to be material. And it can't be real if it isn't material. And he held, and James E. Talmage and B.H. Roberts went along with him on this, that the traditional creeds which hold that God is not material actually assert that God doesn't exist. He would have come off better with the positivists if he hadn't said they are saying really that God doesn't exist, if he had simply said that they're making a lot of nonsense. As a matter of fact, he did say that. There's an interesting thing about Orson Pratt. He held that the traditional theological creeds are nonsense. He used the term absurdity. And the most competent essay by a Mormon leader in theology that is ever written is Orson Pratt's essay, The Absurdity of Immaterialism. It really is quite a brilliant thing when you consider the circumstances under which it was written. He makes all kinds of strange logical errors for which he should not be forgiven. But nevertheless, it's a brilliant piece of work. He held that the theological creeds which hold that that God and the soul are immaterial is absurd, which would delight the positivists, you see. But then he turned around and said, they're atheists, which misses the point of positivism. Because if they really were absurd, they couldn't be false propositions. And if they're not false propositions, those who profess them could not be regarded as atheists. But now to get back to the rather profane dialogue that I've introduced here. You see, a thoughtful Mormon is likely to remember that Joseph Smith said in his account of his first vision, when I came to myself, I was lying on my back looking into the heavens. Now that's what upsets the whole business. The two of the leading positivists, Otto Neurath, who went to the University of London, and Rudolf Carnap, whom I have mentioned, came to the University of Chicago, both held to the position of physicalism as a rather extreme form of positivism, that for a proposition to make genuine sense, and all that means is that for it to be either true or false, for it to make genuine sense, that is to be either true or false, a proposition has to be translatable into what they call the physicalistic language. And the physicalistic language is represented by sentences where the predicates specify a space-time location for what is designated by the subject. These are sentences in physics. And all meaningful propositions turn out to be sentences in physics. Biology is convertible into physics by way of biochemistry and biophysics. And psychology is convertible into biology by way of physiological psychology. And the sociology, which includes the rest of the sciences, so-called social sciences, are convertible into biology through statistical biological studies. And the result of this is that the whole territory of knowledge, that is the whole of the cognitive realm, is capable in principle of being telescoped into physics. Now, as you might know, as physicists who invented this whole thing, Moritz Schlick, the leader of the Viennese Circle, was a physicist, but plenty of people who are not physicists came very, very much into the picture. The point that I'm interested in making now is, you see, in the case of Mormon theology is, if you just stick with physics and convert theology into physics, the way many Mormons actually do, and the way many, many other people actually do, until their theologians corrupt them and tell them they shouldn't do this sort of thing. If you just convert theology into physics, then as far as positivism is concerned, you have a perfectly meaningful theology. But the moment you start talking about, well, I apparently didn't see God with his natural eyes. Just what eyes did he see him with? Well, with his spiritual eyes, or something like that. You see, immediately the physics begins to vanish. And from the standpoint of a positivistic criteria of meaningfulness, the meaningfulness of the sentences begin to dissolve. Begins to dissolve. So if you keep your theology on a very, very crude level, from the standpoint of the positivistic criteria of cognitive meaning, your theology can be entirely meaningful. But the moment you begin to refine it, and by refining it, I don't mean to say that it's no longer a matter of materialism. But the moment you begin to get out of the framework of the possibility of, in principle, of empirical data that has some kind of relevance to the determination of the probability value of the proposition, at that moment, from the standpoint of logical positivism, you enter in, you cross over from physics into metaphysics, and you're lost. You're dabbling in meaninglessness and nonsense. Now, I don't want to leave you on quite such a negative note. Even as celebrated an agnostic as Bertrand Russell, who I think is the greatest thinker of this century, Bertrand Russell refused to go along with the positivists, despite the fact that much of the work of the positivists was based upon Russell's principles of logic and his logical analyses. And the same is true of his student, celebrated creative philosopher at Cambridge, Ludwig Wittgenstein, who is often thought of as a positivist, but not genuinely a positivist. There are plenty of people who are heavily involved in empirical methodology who have never been willing to go along with the positivists in their holding that metaphysics, which includes, you see, cultivated theology, is cognitively meaningless. But I must say those very people have had a very, very difficult time, it seems to me, explaining why they haven't been willing to go along with the positivists. In the case of Bertrand Russell, you have very celebrated papers on the limits of empiricism, that there are definite limits to empirical knowledge, and it's the limits which he placed upon the possibilities of empirical knowledge which seems to have prevented him from agreement with the positivists. I don't mean to say that if a person is going to be empirically grounded in his knowledge claims, that he cannot, some way or another, come up with a meaningful theology without indulging in a lot of crude metaphysics or physics for his theology. What I do mean to say is that if you want to take theology seriously and want to get at the structure of theology, now the best way of getting at it is to go at it historically and to see the development of theology in the Occident, particularly in Islam and Catholicism and Protestantism, to see it historically. Theology, like philosophy and unlike science, bears the burden of its past. You cannot understand it without understanding its past. So the historical approach to it is tremendously important. But then if you want to get at it in a kind of systematic way and get at it in terms of the logic of the problem, I would strongly urge that you take seriously, not that you settle for it, but I would strongly urge that you take seriously the critique of theology that is developed by the 20th century positivists. There ought to be a run. They ought to have them out in the hall, but they're not there, I'm sure. There ought to be a run on A.J. Ayer's little book because it's so beautifully written, so delightful to read. You take it to a basketball game, as I did, and never look at the game. Just read the book. And read his chapter. Really read the whole thing in one sitting. Read his chapter on ethics and theology. And there you will find set forth in the plainest Queen's English the thing that every serious person who wants to dabble in theology has got to contend with. It's like they used to say in the history of philosophy, you can't go around Immanuel Kant. You just got to go through him. And that's what I think about serious-minded theology. You can't go around the positivists. You don't have to settle for them. You might fake it and kind of jump over them. But the best thing to do is to go through them. That takes 20 or 30 years, so you better get an early start.